Good.
Right. We're going to call this meeting to order. This is the Wednesday, April 3rd, 2013 meeting of the Transportation and Public Safety Finance Division. Members, I have a few announcements. First of all, we're on TV, so a little secret signal to say hello to your mom is in order. A quick note. We've been posting our handouts on the Scribd or ScribeD website. Now we have the capacity to just put them right up on the Senate committee webpage. So that's where they're going to be uploaded to now from now on. That's www.senate.mn/schedule. Just a little bit about the coming days. This Friday, 10 o'clock in the morning, we're going to be discussing the governor's budget proposals, as well as the proposal from Progress in Motion. And just wanted to let members know that these bills are both for discussion purposes. Then we'll lay the bills on the table. Then on Monday, we'll be hearing several more finance bills. Then we'll be putting the committee bill on the presented and laid that on the table. And then on Wednesday, a week from today, we'll do markup and if you like it, we'll pass it out of committee. So that's a week from today. We'll do amendments and markup at that time. With that, welcome to the committee, Senator Rest.
Thank you.
Senator Rest has Senate File 1079.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you have two bills, Senate 303 or 1079. Which would you like to start with?
We can start with 1079.
All right, very good.
Since that's the one you just announced. Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 1079 came to me from the former police chief of Robbinsdale, which is one of the cities that I represent, and is a proposal that deals with additional training for all of those in the public sector who are charged with providing safety for all of us, and in particular, additional training for those who are dealing with returning veterans who have at times have very, very special needs as they are reintegrating into non-military life, and the to make sure that they are that the veterans are accorded the dignity that we want to make sure that they maintain, but also for law enforcement in particular to recognize the special circumstances of their experiences when they're dealing with them in times of crisis of any kind, and we can all imagine the kinds of crises that families face and the special kinds of crises that returning veterans and their families face. So this bill sets up a training program with an appropriation, particularly for this one organization that Chief Chalom has been associated with since his retirement as the police chief of Robbinsdale, to use in training community safety personnel when they are dealing with veterans who find themselves in a crisis situation. So we do have some people here, I believe they're here, to testify and to give a little bit more background, Mr. Chairman. Otherwise, the bill itself is just a straightforward appropriation for those folks. And I did have communication from NAMI, which I thought was very important, and how the services that are currently available for training safety personnel for those that for those members of the public that they encounter who are having a mental health crisis of some sort. And that training is very important. This is, I think, a very specialized training that we're talking about in this bill, in that it is dealing with the circumstances that returning veterans find themselves in, and the particular kinds of crises that they encounter. So if you would please, Mr. Chairman, if my testifiers could speak.
Great, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Which of you would like to start?
I guess that would be me, Mr. Chairman.
All right, please introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is Wayne Shellum. I work for the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute. I was police chief that Senator Ress referred to, 32 years in law enforcement for the state of Minnesota and the city of Robbinsdale. And I joined the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute located in Woodbury, I did that in 2008. I flunked retirement. It lasted about a month and a half. And I thank you for your time. It's a topic that I also I should add that I served for 6 years in the Minnesota National Guard, 1970 to 1976. The current program that we have, and we're a nonprofit in Woodbury and have been in existence for quite a while, and I think that I supplied the executive summary of this particular bill to each of you. The emphasis on this, in this particular training, is on veterans in crisis and public safety's response. It is a 8-hour class that we initially, back in 2008, just after I joined the Institute, we applied for and received a small grant from the Minnesota Office of Justice Programs to do an awareness training in conjunction with the Yellow Ribbon Committee and the Yellow Ribbon effort in the state of Minnesota. We did this in 2009. We traveled around the state and trained over 150 people an awareness type of training as far as public safety and the reintegration challenges of our veterans. Through that short time, we realized that and got feedback from many of our students, which were largely law enforcement, but there was also some police chaplains and other public safety personnel, to include emergency medical people, that it's all fine and dandy, but we need to know, and we'd like to have some more tactics and strategies, and like to learn a little bit about more about what our veterans have gone through and what we can do to de-escalate situations specifically for veterans. And as a result, we took that information and have developed a class that we did get a grant from the COPS office in Washington, D.C., and for the last year and a half, we've been delivering that class across the country. And that particular class, we've learned a lot from. We've learned a lot of officers and other public safety personnel are having other questions. There's a lot of things that we need to add, and I think that in this particular bill, we want to make it Minnesota specific. I've traveled all around the country, and I could give you stories from many parts of our country, and there's a lot of issues that have come up that have been kind of unique. But no matter what, when we talk about the Yellow Ribbon, and it started here in Minnesota, and I'm quite proud of it. It's gone across the country to many, many different states. Not everybody, but many different states. And we we're looked upon across the country as kind of a cutting edge, and part of the emphasis on this particular training and is on officer safety. It's a very big issue. We've had issues with officers and of getting injured significantly so by veterans who are in crisis, and we through this training have been pretty successful in getting some great feedback and talking about how de-escalation tactics and active listening and various other things and learning what a veteran signs of what a veteran looks like. Many of our officers and public safety people across the state have never served, and they're in a unique position where they just don't quite get the signals. So that's part of what we're proposing and to make this Minnesota specific so that we can train our public safety personnel. And when I say that, I'm including dispatchers, law enforcement officers, deputies, and we've even had some medical folks that have interest in this type of thing. We propose to – that's partially to make it Minnesota-specific, and it's been well-received across the country. I am convinced that we can do it in Minnesota. I've had requests for this class from Albert Lea, Marshall, Morris, Duluth, Ramsey County, all over the state, and with budgets, as you know a lot better than I do, the challenges of budgets in city and counties, that the money isn't really there, and that's one of the things that we've run into. As I said, you know better than I do, but as a former chief of police, training money and training budgets are very, very thin, and without this appropriation and without the support, it very likely wouldn't happen because cities and counties just don't have the money, which not only includes tuition but replacing officers that go to training. So there's other aspects that are Minnesota specific that I can turn over to my partner in training to kind of expand on, but with that, I'll end my statement.
Thank you, Mr. Schulman. And first, very quickly, I'd like to indicate that a quorum is present. Thank you. Mr. Baker.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm the military component to this. My name is John Baker. I'm retired from the United States Marine Corps. I spent 22 years in the Marine Corps. I retired as a gunnery sergeant in the Marine Corps. Was a former drill instructor, and after I retired, I went to law school. I see Senator Reinhart shaking his head over there that you probably dealt with a drill instructor that was a gunny in the Marine Corps. So I went to law school, graduated from law school, and now I practice in representing veterans throughout the state of Minnesota. I also chair the Minnesota State Bar Association Military and Veterans Affairs section. And I do a lot of education of the public safety and the criminal in veterans in the criminal justice system. Well, over 2 million Americans have now served in these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. A third of those Americans have done multiple tours. There's many service members I talked to that have done 4 and 5 combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Navy SEALs that took down bin Laden a couple years ago, many of them had done 15 combat tours. A 500,000 of those Americans were National Guardsmen and reservists. We have the distinction here in Minnesota of our Minnesota National Guard serving the longest tour in Iraq of any combat unit, bar none, in the United States. So we've had a lot of Minnesotans that have served in these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, a third of these Americans that have served are coming back with mental health issues, with some form of post-traumatic stress disorder. Another third of them are coming back with traumatic brain injury. These two, PTSD and TBI, are what are called the signature wounds of these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Many of those service members do not report or seek help for these issues. Many of them then are ending up in our criminal justice system, and the first call for help comes from the backseat of a squad car or from a jail cell. We have done a lot of work here in Minnesota to address the issues of veterans turning up in the criminal justice system. This legislature was, in 2008, the second legislature in the nation to pass what's called the Veteran Sentencing Mitigation Statute. Very proud of that. We've done a lot of work. I was just in a court a couple days ago up in rural Minnesota where we had a Marine combat vet, and we were able to utilize that statute and keep that Marine out of prison and get him treatment. That's been some great work that this legislature did that we've been able to carry out. I chaired the initiative to start veteran courts in Minnesota. We have Hennepin County has a veteran court, which has become the model for the nation, as a matter of fact. And we have Ramsey County, Anoka County, Washington County, and counties throughout the state that are working on some different programs. We need to get one started up in Duluth. We've got a lot of that going on. I've done a lot of education for judges, for prosecutors, for probation officers, of veterans in the criminal justice system. The natural extension of this is we need to teach the first responders, those law enforcement officers that had the first contact with veterans in crisis. And that's what this course does. It does that. This training, what we do is we first of all, we educate these law enforcement personnel, just what the issues veterans face or service members face when they're overseas. I've been there. I've my 22 years in the Marine Corps, I've been overseas. I spent many years deployed. I was in the first Gulf War, so I can speak firsthand of these issues. And I'm representing a lot of these veterans that have been through this. Then we teach the law enforcement what PTSD is about, what TBI is about, what kind of things we need to look for. Then we teach law enforcement de-escalation, actual de-escalation tactics, and that's where Wayne comes in. So we tag team with these courses. We have a retired military and we have a retired police officer that we tag team. We get the police officer then to teach actual tactics on how to deal with these veteran crises. Then, and this is what we've gotten a lot of response on, everywhere that we go, we're bringing to law enforcement, these are the resources you have in your area. Who is the county veteran service officer up in Moorhead, Minnesota? We go to talk to a lot of law enforcement officers. They don't know who their county veteran service officer are. We're connecting them with that. We're also dealing with specific issues with women veterans. And which are never addressed enough. There's a lot of specific issues that women veterans are coming back home with, military sexual trauma issues. How does law enforcement deal with that kind of stuff? That's the type of training that we're doing with this. But what we've really gotten a lot of response is the local resources. We're not only telling law enforcement, here's the problem, here's how to deal with it, but here's what you do with it with that service member. And I'm a criminal defense attorney. I would like every time for a combat veteran to get diverted and to get programming at the St. Cloud VA or the Minneapolis VA instead of then ending up in the Department of Corrections where it's going to cost us a lot more money in the long run. So I think this money that we spend on the front end is good public policy because it's going to hopefully keep veterans out of the criminal justice system in the long term, which is going to cost society more. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Senator Rest, are there any other testifiers or...
I don't believe so, unless you would like to ask if there's anyone who would like to testify either for or against the bill.
Thank you, Senator Rest. And anybody who does have any testimony on this issue, either pro or against, is welcome to come forward. Questions from the committee? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, thanks for your service. Appreciate that very much in both cases. One of the things on PTSD and this makes me think of the fact that in studying up on the subject a little bit, that over in Israel, they have a special training prior to being deployed to help, you might say, inoculate them and prepare them. So their rate of PTSD is very low. And they certainly have a lot to face as well. So I think it's a fair taking a look at, but preemptively. And I think doing this on an upfront basis and dealing with them when they return, but since you are quite knowledgeable about this area, might either one of you just comment on maybe even using some of what you are learning here, sharing it back with the military or something, and what can we do to help? It's great to help them when they come home or do some of these things, but if we can avoid it even being an issue to begin with, might you just address that issue for just a minute or so?
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, the military, the DOD, has done a great deal of work now. You know, when we first started these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, there wasn't a whole lot of work being done on dealing with the issue of PTSD. Now we have, and the Marine Corps, I'm proud to say, was one of the first branches that started this. We're doing resiliency training. We're training our service members before they even go into combat how to deal with these issues and when they're coming back. And then we have the DOD has rapid response teams that are meeting when a unit comes off a firefighter or an engagement. We have these teams that are going decompressing and bringing these soldiers, sailors, Marine, airmen back from that experience. The second part of your question, I think the chief can answer a little bit, if I remember correctly, your second part of your question, are we doing anything going back to the DOD? And I know that we're initially our program was funded through the DOJ and our curriculum was developed through the DOJ. And as a matter of fact, we are going to Washington, D.C. and going to perform this training for the Washington, D.C. police here in May, and there's going to be a lot of folks from the DOJ that are there, and it's a continuing. I know the Institute continually refines this curriculum and continually gives feedback to the DOJ, which I hope is sharing with the DOD, but we know that we're working with the DOJ on this. It's a little bit different dealing with the DOD on this, Senator Kiffmeyer, but we do what we can with that.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. That was very informative. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Baker. Any other questions, members? Senator Pratt?
Not really a question, just more of a comment. I want to thank Senators Ress, Saxhog, and Chamberlain for bringing this bill forward. You know, $100,000 compared to a $35 billion, $38 billion budget is meager, and if we can help our community peace officers de-escalate a situation, and I've had a number of employees come back from deployment. They face a number of different stresses, a number of different crises as they come back to our society, to end any conflict in a nonviolent way for both the community, the peace officers, and the veteran is money well spent. So thank you all for bringing it forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Pratt. Senator Reinert?
Thank you, Chair. And Senator Pratt, to your point, let's not even take that $100,000 and compare it to the $38 billion budget. Let's compare it to the $30,000+ that we spend a year to incarcerate someone, where if we can be more proactive in the back of that squad and get them to the help they need instead of spending time in a jail cell, no matter how much, we're dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars in some case ahead. So
I agree.
Spot on.
You know, Madam Chair, and I think, too, that the folks we're talking about, before they were deployed, most of them had no experience with law enforcement. You know, they had no public crises, either in their family or anger issues or anything like that. It really does come when they return, and they're probably just as surprised that they are having uncomfortable experiences with law enforcement, that they absolutely would not have had prior to their experience in the in combat.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to belabor the point, but we just had a report out yesterday that potentially as many as a third of veterans are coming home with mental health, TBI-related issues, many of them having been left out of the service for personality issues that are really PTSD. And so, you know, Veterans Affairs is looking at ways to allow those folks to come back in to be rescreened to get the help they need. So if we can help at that first point of contact, like the gunny said, I think we're doing everyone a service.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. I apologize. I had to step out. So if this question has been asked, just tell me and I'll get the answer later. I have two questions. First, when police arrive on the scene of a crisis, how do they determine that they're dealing with a veteran? Do we know that?
Madam Chairman, Senator, thank you for the question. That's one of the things that has been kind of an issue, quite frankly. To make this Minnesota specific and to really dig into that specific is that we have developed and are pretty much done with a segment, a module on how to identify a veteran. And from a traffic stop where they may just give you a kind of a military driver's license, and many officers across the country or across the state don't have any idea what that is. And so we have and are continuing through Gunny's help to have a module just on that, and then also how to pick up signs and signals as you approach a house. We have a video in there that has a yellow ribbon on the vehicle and may have some other identifying marks on the vehicle. So it's a real big issue that is out there that I think that we have done and will do a very effective way of how to identify a veteran in the first place.
Great. Thanks.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. And if this has come up, again, just tell me and I'll have a private conversation. But I'm familiar somewhat with the work of the Barbara Schneider Foundation, you know, that was launched in the aftermath of that tragedy. Does this build upon some of that work, dealing with mentally ill people in crisis so that things don't get escalated unnecessarily?
Mr. Schell.
Madam Chair, and Senator, that the Barbara Schneider Foundation does great work. I'm here to tell you, I've seen some of their work, and they're very popular, and they do excellent work. Senator Ress mentioned NAMI. I have personal knowledge and spoken to the executive director of NAMI as well. And some of this material is on the same level as that. What differentiates us from the Barbara Schneider Foundation and who offers law enforcement training, but it's more like critical incident team training and gets into it quite to quite depth, and they do a wonderful, wonderful job. But ours is centered specifically on veterans, and how and it's law enforcement relates to the veteran, using a lot of the same principles that the Barbara Schneider Foundation and NAMI have employed to the general population, and I think that it probably goes without saying that the training that we're offering, the one-day training that we're offering, is not it centers on veterans, but it's not just strictly on veterans. I think that law enforcement and public safety people can use that on other people as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schellen. Additional questions, members? Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also wanted to commend the testifiers, and particularly Mr. Baker. He's a constituent. He's a Minnesota Lawyer of the Year. He has devoted his career following his tours of duty in behalf of veterans, the Veterans Court, and other things. And thank you for being here.
Thank you. Well, if there are no other questions, then we will lay Senate File 1079 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Senators, members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have
Senator Gress, Senate File 303.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 04, Senate File 303. I do have a delete everything amendment. It's the A6.
Members, I believe that's in your packet already.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would move the A6.
Okay. This is an author's amendment, first hearing. All in favor of the A6, say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion passes. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chairman. The Senate File 303 attempts, which I hope this time is going to be successful, in dealing with bringing stability to the state airports fund, also making sure that the revenues that go in there are encourage the general aviation industry in Minnesota, and we think we have found finally a unique and also long-term solution to those to that dilemma. What's happened, by the way, in the past is the airports fund has been a favorite object of rating when the people who control our budget targets say, well, we just need another $5 million and we'll solve a problem. And they look at the airports fund, and all of a sudden it's depleted. The airports fund is used for any number of safety features to fund those on a revolving basis around the state. And we think that we're hoping that this time it's going to work. So what we're proposing in order to accomplish that goal is, if you look at Section 1, first of all, to impose an excise tax of 15 cents per gallon on jet and special fuel that will later be refundable, to continue the nickel a gallon tax on aviation gasoline, not refundable, and I hope you're staying with me here. And then, furthermore, exempting some types of items associated with the aviation industry from the sales tax. So we move from 296A09 to 296.17, and then we find ourselves in the eventually in the sales tax systems 360 in the statutes, and there at 360, and so on. Those funds then are deposited in the state airports fund. It's sales tax dollars that are deposited there. And then the registration tax is applied using a rate chart rather than, as you see, the language that's stricken, rather than a percentage of the price. So and then we have in section, when we get to section 10, we have a report requested from the Commissioner of Transportation in conjunction with the Commissioner of Revenue to identify the amount and sources of the annual revenues that are attributable to each type of aviation tax that's imposed in here, along with the annual expenditures from the State Airports Fund and any other transfers out on a rolling basis going forward every 4 years. So that is how we are attempting here to deal with the stability of the fund. We do understand that it is a transfer of general fund sales tax dollars into the airports fund. And Mr. Chairman, the tax committee is willing to deal with the dilemma of diverting general fund sales tax dollars into the airports fund and will cover the costs in their bill. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I do have testifiers that can give a little bit of history for just how we've gone about getting ourselves into this dilemma, particularly with some of the policies that we have now in Minnesota that have been very discouraging to registering aircraft in Minnesota because it's so prohibitively expensive.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Mr. Hoff,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my name is Gordon Hoff, Executive Director of the Minnesota Business Aviation Association. Thank you for hearing this bill today. So Senator Rest indicated we have worked on this issue for several years, and we believe we have agreement with the Minnesota Office of Aeronautics, the airlines, the Minnesota Council of Airports. So I think the aviation community is pretty solidly behind this attempt to bring the aircraft registration into the 21st century along with our fuel tax. In your packets, I believe you have some handouts that will I'd like to talk through those. The history of the business and general aviation aircraft. We started in 1945, and we've had three changes to the aircraft registration, 57, 87, and in 1999, the aerial applicators came in, and when they started to buy more expensive turbine aircraft, they were able to secure a cap of $500 for their aircraft registration. The fuel tax, since 1945, I want to point out that Minnesota currently is one of the lowest fuel tax in the country. In 2008, the Department of Revenue determined it was about 0.7 cents per gallon. You notice that we have a sliding scale. It's 500,000, 50,000. It's 5 cents today. It was 4 cents, and in 1951, it went up a penny to 5 cents. And you can imagine what gas cost in 1951 compared to what it costs today, probably 50 cents a gallon to $5 a gallon between then and now. And then it goes down to 2 cents for the next 100,000, and then 1 cent for 150 to 200, and a half cent above 200,000 gallons, making us one of the lower priced, and that's both on avgas and jet fuel. And 96% of the jet fuel is burned by the airlines. About 4% of that is burned by the business aircraft in the state. So they are the largest consumers of the fuel by far. The flight property tax has been changed 4 times, and so they have also seen some changes. If you look at the next slide, there's a graph. The blue graph is the air flight property tax. You notice that graph is there, that bar. It stayed fairly stable throughout the history. I only could go back to 1976 and get reasonable, accurate data. The red line is aircraft registration, and the green line is fuel, and you can see the red and green have changed places over the years. And so fuel has gone from, the next slide will show you that fuel has gone from 46% of the revenue to 20%, and business aircraft registration has gone from 12% to 33.5%. A substantial change in flight property tax has remained in the low to mid 40 range. The next slide is shows you a $5 million aircraft. North Dakota, being one of the lower priced states to register an aircraft, after 7 years goes down to a total of $1,500. In Iowa, the highest state around us, no plane can pay more than $5,000. That's why it stays at $5,000. And it In Minnesota, we are at 1% of the value, and I must point out that I was also at 1% of the value in year one, but no plane can pay more than $5,000, so they cap it. And in Minnesota, we stay at 1%, and then we go down to 0.25% after 7 years, and you can see that we pay $212,000 over that seven-year period compared to $35,000 or $1,500. The next slide is a medium-sized jet that'll carry eight people with a range of about 3,000 miles. And in North Dakota, it would be $4,500 to register that airplane after 7 years. Iowa stays at the $35,000. In Minnesota, it's $850,000. So it gets quite expensive compared to our neighbors. Minnesota is the highest priced place to register an airplane in the first year. And after 7 years, we're still in the top three. The next slide shows if we were to pass this bill, we would drop from that $850,000 down to $105,000. So we're not eliminating aircraft registration. We certainly want to make pay our fair share and make sure that the airports are adequately funded to use. I mean, obviously, when you take off and land, it's nice to have good airports with good navigational aids, and Minnesota certainly has some of the best in the country. The last slide you have shows a projection of 2014. We compare with FY12, and I just want to point out the green and purple line there in 2012. We're about the same. And in FY14, you notice that aircraft registration is a little bit less than what the flight property tax is going to be. But we believe that over time, this will be a welcoming bill. If we can take the sales tax from the aircraft sales and put that into the general fund, from the general fund into the state airport fund, it goes a long way in securing adequate and adequate funding for the state airport fund. The sales tax elimination on parts and associated labor, we'll have some people talking about that in greater detail, but we believe that is going to be a job creator, and several states across the country have done that, and they have data that proves that eliminating their sales tax has generated more business. And as you can imagine, an aircraft is a very mobile asset. And we've had companies in Florida advertising, come to Florida, there's no sales tax. Massachusetts has shown that it's been a money gainer for jobs and on the income tax. And close to home, Missouri, Michigan, and Ohio don't have a sales tax. And we find that, as they'll testify, we're competing with doing maintenance work in Florida, California. Maine is another state. With that, I'll stand for any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Huff. Any questions, members? No? Okay.
It's Sean.
Maybe Mr. Burke?
No, this is Sean Jermolis is next. We mixed up your list a little bit, if that's all right, Mr.
Right. We met
Chair.
Earlier in my office. Welcome, Mr. Jermolis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sean Jermolis. I'm currently the executive director of the Chisholm-Hibbing Airport Authority, but today represent the Minnesota Council of Airports as its chair. Minnesota is very fortunate to possess one of the nation's best airport systems. This has occurred and can only continue because of the commitment to adequately fund the Minnesota State Aviation Fund. This fund provides the vital dollars for airport construction, airport equipment purchasing, and reimbursements of a portion of the airport's operational and maintenance expenses. State Airport Fund obtains its dollars through aircraft registration fees, fuel taxes, and airline property fees, or user fees. As Gordon mentioned, it does not receive any money raised through taxes on aircraft and aircraft parts sales. The funds do go into the state's general fund, unlike other forms of transit which have dedicated sales taxes. The airports have been, currently are, and desire to continue to be self-supporting, utilizing these user fees, and believe this bill is one that will help us achieve that objective. For the State Aviation Fund, approximately $18 million annual budget, airport expenses utilize approximately $8 to $10 million per year. The capital improvement projects list generated by MnDOT Aeronautics this year in January actually had over $17 million in airport funding requests. The five-year capital improvement project list projects requests of over $595 million, of which $58.7 million would be considered state eligible. It's imperative that the state aviation fund remains fully funded and revenue sources are encouraged to grow to meet these requests and, or more importantly, leverage federal funding sources, which the airports and MnDOT Aeronautics does an excellent job of obtaining these outside federal funding sources to enhance our construction funds. In summary, this bill enables the state aviation fund to remain whole and assist in funding our state's airports with this revenue-neutral proposal, which MCOA strongly advocates. It will assist our partners, the Minnesota aircraft owners and maintenance operators, with reducing high costs of doing business and providing a competitive environment. A healthy environment translates to more aviation activity, more jobs with well above minimum wage salaries, and more revenue to the state aviation fund to maintain the excellent aviation and airport system that we enjoy today. The Minnesota Council of Airports requests your support in passing this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Jamalis. Any questions, members? Oh, all right, thank you. We have a few more folks on the list. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is Glenn Burke. I'm the airport manager for Fleming Field, South St. Paul Municipal Airport. Mr. Chairman and Chairman, committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. Fleming Field is the home to 18 aviation-related businesses, and over 300 employees show up to work every day. At those businesses, they cut, sew, paste, fold, and pack parachutes larger than the ceiling of this room into packages as small as that projector to our right. They rivet, glue, paint, upholster, buy, sell, trade, barter, repair, refurbish, renew, strip and paint, engineer, draft, re-engineer, and machine aircraft parts and whole aircraft themselves. It is the place where old aircraft come to be renewed, reinvigorated. They come out flying further, faster, and lifting more capacity. Those 300 employees that come to work each day are at a competitive disadvantage right now with the states of Ohio and Florida and Massachusetts. Our state law now requires our employers at South St. Paul Airport to collect sales tax on major improvements to planes and the labor that is put into it. Currently, our major employer at South St. Paul Airport has a new product they are offering. It's a $400,000 upgrade to a business aircraft, a 10-seat business aircraft. It costs about $400,000, and there's about $1,500 worth or 1,500 hours of labor by aircraft technicians that make in the neighborhood of $60,000 to $70,000 a year. This program will land in a state, hopefully Minnesota, and the 18 technicians that they will hire for it to refurbish these aircraft. This bill will help to ensure that it lands here in Minnesota. The reduction of the sales tax would be a great advantage to this company, as they have the ability to locate this work anywhere in the country because these aircraft are so mobile and they can do it outside of our borders. So for the city of South St. Paul, the other advantage for our city is that right now we see that aircraft that use our system are not located within the state of Minnesota. They base their aircraft in border communities. For the city of South St. Paul, Duluth, those communities may see some return of these aircraft over time, or when companies buy new aircraft, we'll be at less of a competitive disadvantage when they come in and then they look at the aircraft registration fees. Thank you for your for the opportunity to testify. If you have any questions.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Burke. Questions for Mr. Burke? All right. Thank you. Ms. Walters?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Tracy Walter. I'm the Director of Operations and also a pilot for Bemidji Aviation Services with a headquarters in Bemidji, Minnesota. We are in support of Senate File 303. We believe it'll make us a much more business-friendly aviation state. I've currently been employed for Bemidji Aviation for 13 years, and I hope to finish my career there. Bemidji Aviation has been in business for 43 years. We were started as a mom-and-pop type operation. The former owners believed the company was a great place to be and family-friendly, and decided out of the goodness of their hearts to make it an employee shared ownership plan, ESOP company, in 2006. They wanted their vision to continue to grow in general aviation and in the charter and freight business, which is one of our major money intakes. We mostly operate in the state of Minnesota, but also in the outlying areas of Wisconsin, North, and South Dakota. As I said, we run a passenger and charter operation. We are also qualified for aerial wildland firefighting throughout Minnesota and the United States. So we go outside of Minnesota and bring back federal tax dollars and spend them in Minnesota. And we keep Minnesota money in Minnesota. There are not many companies in the U.S. that do what we do, although there are big companies that do what we do in South Dakota, North Dakota, and Wisconsin, and they are our major competitors. And they do not have taxes the way we do. We have 53 employees, many of which are homeowners, around the Bemidji area and in the metro area. 20 of our pilots live not just in Bemidji, but in your communities, as Duluth, Eveleth, Thief River Falls, Marshall, Alexandria, Detroit Lakes, and of course around the Minneapolis area. On any given day, you could see one of our aircraft at those airports. Our aircraft fly approximately 6 days a week, Sundays as well, but most of our operation is a six-day-a-week operation. They also contribute to those jobs at those airports with fueling, de-icing, and basic FBO services. My husband is our chief pilot, and we both grew up here, and we'd love to stay in Minnesota as a business-friendly state. We raise two small children at home, and our company is very family-friendly. I do my best to schedule our pilots so they can attend all their children's activities and still be and do a job they love to do, flying airplanes, because when you fly an airplane, you love flying an airplane. We'd like to grow and buy more aircraft, and we believe with the reduction in the sales and use tax and the registration fees in Minnesota, we could go forward into buying larger aircraft. The last aircraft purchase was astronomical in price, and we went to pay the tax bill, and we all went, oh, my goodness. In conclusion, this bill would level the playing field with our competitors. We compete not just with people and companies based in Wisconsin, North Dakota, and South Dakota, but as far away as Texas and California. This would also let us do more and be more customer-friendly in the maintenance and major upgrades in avionics, which is something that is very expensive to do. Just like buying a new TV, avionics upgrades in your airplanes are very expensive. With the reduction of the sales and use tax, we would be able to do these at a much less cost, and they wouldn't have to go outside of the state. We can keep jobs here in Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
And thank you, Ms. Walter. Any questions, members? Great. Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Lindsay.
Yes, Senator. All right. Chair, committee members, thank you for your time this afternoon. I'm Tom Lindsay. I am the general manager, one of five partners in MSP Aero. We're based in Minneapolis at the International Airport, and we have an office at Anoka County Key Air facility. We are a new company. We will be in business this summer. It'll be 4 years. And a quick background about us. Four of the partners, we were laid off from our jobs in aviation right here in Minnesota. And we all wanted to stay in Minnesota and raise our families. And the job market at the time was very poor. So we decided, to start a business, which kind of not very smart in the economic times we had 4 years ago. Business aviation is strong in Minnesota. There's a need for the service that we do. We're a FAA repair station. We provide maintenance on avionics equipment. As was testified, avionics equipment, it's new technology. It's constantly evolving. So new installations occur quite frequently. But in the 4 years, we have determined through analysis based on we were providing a lot of quotes to customers, and a number of them, we'd love to capture all those jobs, but and realistically, we know we're not going to, but some of them, we're wondering why we weren't achieving that. Through the analysis, we determined that we're at a competitive disadvantage based on the sales and labor tax in the state of Minnesota. And as you heard earlier testimony, a number of states, they either exempt it or have various levels of tax, whether it's on parts or labor. And as Gordon mentioned, the state of Massachusetts, they prepared a study for the legislature after enacting the exemption, and they found that based aircraft in their state increased. And with that increase, it's led to growth in airport-related activities and creating new aviation jobs and investment in the state. Another study, which from the state of Pennsylvania, just this past January, and it was from the, it's a special report from the Independent Fiscal Office, and some quotes from that is, purchases of aircraft parts and MRO services have qualities that suggest consumers would be responsive to the prices. Also, it seems likely that the strongest effect of the exemption would be the retention of residents who might otherwise purchase parts and services out of state. And that's part of what we've experienced. We've went back to the customers where we lost the quote or lost the job. They've elected to fly the aircraft to a state that does not have sales tax. And given the mobility of the aircraft, it's quite common for that to happen, and we'd like to keep those jobs in the state and improve the economic level here in Minnesota. So the intent for us is not to really give a break to the aircraft owners. It is to create a positive economic impact in the state of Minnesota. In turn, it supports small businesses. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lindsay. Questions, members? All right, thank you. Mr. Davidman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Jeff Davidman with Delta Airlines, and I will be brief. As Gordon and Senator Rest said in their introductory comments, this is an issue that's been around for quite some time, 5 or 6 or even 7 years. There's been task force put together to look at it, and rarely have all the stakeholders been able to come together and find a unique and creative solution that allows business aviation, general aviation, to accomplish their goals, but also allows the fund to remain revenue neutral. And I just wanted to say that this proposal, for the first time that I've been working on it, achieves all those goals. And for that, I wanted to thank Senator Ress and the other stakeholders. And it's a proposal that the airlines, not just Delta, but the other airlines, are able to be comfortable with going forward.
Great. Thank you. Questions, members? Nope. All right.
Senator Dibble.
Senator Kent.
Thank you. I just want to go back to something Mr. Lindsay said and see if you could expand on it briefly, that this isn't so much a tax break for aircraft owners but tax reform. And in my looking at this issue, I really appreciate what everybody has done to bring that. Can you just expand on that a little bit more, please?
Well, the aircraft owners and operators, a lot of the maintenance planning or improvements to the aircraft, a lot of planning goes into that expense, and it's planned many, many months in advance. And if they have the option to relocate the aircraft to another facility outside of the state at a more economic cost, they're going to do that. And it's part of what we do. We just do avionics work. We don't do the maintenance, whether it's inspection on the airframe or the engines. So operators like to combine airframe maintenance, engine maintenance, avionics all at the same time, reduce the downtime of the aircraft. And so they'll usually go to a facility that has that capability. Well, what happened 4 years ago, General Dynamics, based at Minneapolis Airport, they closed. There was about 90 maintenance technicians, personnel that left the state. And a good portion of that business followed to Wisconsin. And so by increasing the benefit, the economic impact in Minnesota can bring those jobs back and that capability back to the area. If I answered your question.
Yes, thank you. I think you've well illustrated the nature of the reform of this in a very positive direction. So thank you.
Great. Thank you. Further questions, members? So, Senator Est, this is going to the Tax Committee.
Finance. Well, I believe it has to go up to Finance, right, and then over to, and then from there over to the Tax Committee.
Correct.
So I would move that Senate File 303, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the full Finance Committee.
I did have one question, even though it's in the domain and purview of the Tax Committee, and you told us already they're going to worry about it. But what is the impact of the general fund of the sales tax exemption?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we this bill has been a work in progress, and we had to we're still waiting on a final revenue estimate. We don't expect it to be more than a few million dollars at this point, but we hesitate to say until we see actually what the revenue estimate will be. So we'll certainly report back to the committee to let you know the answer to that.
Well, there's a certain poetic justice to it, though. There's a certain poetic justice to it that the general fund will have to pick up a little bit of the slack.
Yes, we understand that.
Very good.
We're willing to take the burden.
All right. Just a little step towards a little justice over time. So on the Senator Rest motion to refer Senate File 303 as amended to the Finance Committee, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
All right, so members, I think we're going to revert back to the agenda and go to the top. Senator Tomasoni. Tomasoni, Senate File 300.
Thank you.
Delete all amendment, is that correct?
Yes, there's a delete all amendment, Mr. Chairman, which is the A1, I believe.
This is an author's amendment, first hearing. The A1 amendment is in your packet, members. All in favor of the A1, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Senate File 300 is the bill that changes the titling fees for motor vehicle transactions, and basically what it seeks to do is eliminate the imposition of the title transfer fee by combining the $7.25 title fee and the $6.50 title transfer fee into a single $8.25 fee. And so it actually ends up reducing the total amount of title fees here, and I think somehow it ends up saving money too. So I think I'll turn this over to Ms. Schlander, and she can tell you what's going on.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Schlander.
Thank you, members, and Mr. Chair, members. Mr. Chair, this is a bill that is seeking to eliminate a confusing and sort of unfair fee that gets tacked on to motor vehicle transactions. As Senator Tomasoni said, what we have is a fee that applies in about maybe 20% of the total universe of motor vehicle sales transactions, and it applies based upon the number of times a used vehicle transfers ownership at the wholesale level. And so oftentimes what ends up happening is that when the retail seller is collecting the taxes that are due in order to transfer the title of the used vehicle into the customer's name, they don't always have all the paperwork that has come that follows the vehicle. That's just the reality of the paper system that we deal with. And so oftentimes a retailer is sort of guessing about how many times they need to apply the $6.50 title transfer fee based upon where they know the vehicle has already been in the wholesale chain. And so this guessing, as you can pretty easily imagine, oftentimes results in the incorrect amount of fee being charged, either being overcharged and the retailer has to then refund the customer to the, you know, 12 or 13, you know, 650 times, however many you guess wrong. So you write a small check back to the customer. Or in the case of, you know, undercharging the customer, then the dealership is just eating the cost for lack of a better alternative. So what we did is we worked with Driver and Vehicle Services because, you know, as much of a hassle as it is for us, it's also a hassle for the department to have these small amounts of fees that are being refunded and incorrect and flagged. So we wanted to work with them and come up with a solution that would be as close to revenue neutral as we could possibly get, given the fact that we're kind of dealing with guesses on volume of transaction. We couldn't quite get to an absolute zero fiscal note on this. But what we did was in eliminating the $6.50 fee, which applies to some transactions, we just bumped up a fee that applies to most transactions to bring the fiscal impact to a minimal amount. And in addition, because the department is a fee-based budget at DVS, we wanted to be very cognizant to not screw up their budget and their plans for the technology upgrades specifically that they're relying on for the current fees that they're collecting. And so the provisions of this legislation don't become effective until fiscal year 2017, and that, you know, coincides with some of their major projects. So as far as I know, nobody is opposed to this legislation. Like, say, we worked with DVS to make sure that it worked for everybody in the stakeholder chain, and I hope you can support it.
Great. Thank you. Questions, members? All right. Did anyone else want to testify on this? All right. Senator Tomasoni, do you have a motion?
Yes, I would. Are you putting this in the omnibus bill or is it going to the floor?
Well, I understand that it's moving on its own in the House, so we can do both if you like.
All right, then let's move that Senate File 300 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. Or does this have to go to finance?
It needs to be referred to finance, I guess.
Okay.
Bounce out of finance into onto the floor. So, okay. Senator Tomasoni's motion. That Senate File 300, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to finance. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
All right. Senator Champion. Senate File 381. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Senate File 381 addresses a current inequity in covering the cost of processing driver's license applications by deputy registrars in Minnesota. Deputy registrars, also known as driver's license agents, perform these duties at no cost to state government. They rely solely on the filing fee from these transactions to cover the expenses, which include salary, rent, insurance, security, utilities, and IT costs, just to name a few. Furthermore, all paper applications received for driver's license transactions must now be placed in a secured storage facility for 15 years, as per policy, DVS policy, which is an additional cost as well. The current fee of $5 has not changed since 2005, but the responsibility of driver's license agents have grown in relation to these transactions since then. A new triple check procedure to verify the identity of those seeking all IDs requires additional staff time. Also does a new requirement for commercial driver's license holders to submit a medical fitness form every 2 years. Deputies across the state are now losing money accepting driver's license applications on an average of well over $2 per transaction. Deputy offices operated by cities and counties have needed local subsidies to maintain their operations, which usually comes from property tax proceeds. For an example, Hennepin County last year needed to subsidize their offices by $1.5 million. And this was after they had acted to close one of their locations to save money. Without this filing fee increase, other offices across the state may be facing a similar decision to cease operation, which would be a great disservice to citizens, especially those in rural areas. To date, nearly 30 counties and cities in the past 4 months across Minnesota have passed local resolutions calling on the legislature to increase this specific filing fee. So Minnesota Statute 171.061, Subdivision 4, specifically states that this filing fee shall cover all expenses involved in accepting driver's license applications and forwarding them to the department. Enacting Senate File 381 will address the current inequity imposed on all deputy registrars losing money performing this task for citizens and the state. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would love to have my testifiers proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Hurst.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst, and I am here today on behalf of the Minnesota Deputy Registrars Association. Also joining me today is Mr. Jeff Orth, a deputy registrar himself. Mr. Chairman and committee members, I think my comments will be brief because I think our chief author here has done a fantastic job outlining the issue here. But in essence, deputy registrars, for those who are new to the committee, are appointed by the state. They receive no funding from the state to provide the services within your local communities. The system for deputy registrars has been established since the late 1940s, whereby these offices should be self-sufficient and that they survive solely on the filing fees that they realize with the transactions that they perform with the citizens. As Senator Champion mentioned, the filing fee, which is the only amount that the deputy office retains for their operations, is currently $5 for driver's license transactions. That has not been increased in 8 years, but unfortunately, costs have risen for us. Duties and responsibilities have increased over that time as well, and so we are respectfully asking for consideration for this fee increase, which only the legislature can allow. With that, Mr. Chairman, certainly I want to be respectful of your time here today, and I think our other testifier could certainly forego his comments, and we could perhaps jump to questions and expedite things.
Very good. Questions, members? Oh, all right. Senator Champion, what is your pleasure? Let me first, I keep forgetting to do this. Would anyone else like to testify on this bill? Not seeing anyone. Senator Champion.
And it's my understanding, Mr. Chair, is this bill pathway supposed to go to finance, like the bigger finance committees will?
Yeah. Whatever your pleasure is, Senator. So it does have to go to finance if it moves by itself, absolutely.
Yes. So I make the motion that this particular bill moves to pass, be recommended to pass, and go to finance.
All right. Any questions on the champion motion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All right. Senator Franzen. Senator Franzen, which bill would you like to start with?
Mr. Chair, with Senate File 682, if that's okay with you.
All right, 682. Thank you. All right, Senator Franzen, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 682, this legislation will invest an additional $5 million each year of the biennium for the Youth Intervention Program. This is a great investment on two fronts. The first is our investment in our kids.
Youth who participate in intervention programs do better in school, have better life skills, and 90% don't commit a new offense while in a program. The second investment is in our budget. When considering the cost of alternatives such as incarceration or recidivism, this is a great deal for Minnesota. A recent study by the Walder Research and the University of Minnesota found every dollar invested in youth intervention programs receives a $4.89 return on investment. At $2,000 a year per youth, the state's investment in intervention programs are more cost-effective than alternatives like residential treatment, which has a price tag of $75,000 a year, group homes that has a price tag of $56,000 a year, or juvenile correction facilities, which cost $40,000 a year per youth. YIPA, and we'll have representatives from the Youth Intervention Program Association, has a great track record in helping youth in school and improving goal settings skills. These skills that will last the rest of their lives, and we should continue to support YIPA's efforts. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Scott Beatty. Mr. Beatty is the Executive Director of the Minnesota Youth Intervention Programs Association.
Welcome, J. Scott Beatty.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. Again, for the record, my name is Scott Beatty, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Youth Intervention Programs Association. Quickly, just to give you a little bit of information about YIPA, we are a nonprofit collaborative organization currently comprised of about 110 youth intervention programs from around the state of Minnesota. In addition to bringing these organizations together to share programs and best practices, YIPA also provides trainings to approximately 1,500 youth service providers annually, and this is growing. We believe that well-trained youth service professionals will provide the best possible services to our youth, and as you can imagine, a youth-serving organization is only as good as its least trained staff. You know, I could probably talk for an hour on our training program, but I believe you had there was a list of our trainings provided to the committee, so I won't go over those, but what we try to do is provide this year about 25 different trainings in a variety of different formats, and we try to keep these trainings affordable, and we seek sponsorships and foundation support to try to keep our training costs at 40 to 60% below what their actual cost is to the attendees. I have the honor today to appearing before you to talk about Senate File 682, which does two things. First, it asks for an expansion of the Youth Intervention Program, which has been it's been around for 35 years and is incredibly effective. I believe you also, in your packet of information, there was a really good survey results that were put together by the Office of Justice Programs that showed the kind of results that this program has. The second part of the bill is to change the percentage that YIPA gets to provide training and technical assistance and also work with Office of Justice Programs to make sure that the grantees are measuring and providing good outcomes for what they're doing. So let me give you a little history on the Youth Intervention Program. It's 36 years old. Just starting to be 36 years old. And the intent of the original program was to provide ongoing operating support to community-based agencies by leveraging community dollars. So for every dollar these programs get from the state, up to a maximum of $50,000, each organization has to come up with $2 in community funding for every dollar they get from the state. Now, no program has ever gotten the $50,000 because it hasn't been, the actual funding hasn't been high enough to have that happen. So what's youth intervention? It's a concept that works with youth that are just beginning to get in, that show signs of trouble or troublesome behaviors. It could be shoplifting, it could be truancy, it could be vandalism, bullying, drug and alcohol use. or other, you know, violent problems, those kind of things, that the idea is to grab these kids early, right when they're starting to get in trouble, work with them, and keep them out of the juvenile justice system. So the idea is to save money on the front end, actually save money on the back end by putting money into the front end. The program's goals are to use mentoring, counseling, restorative justice, education, and diversion programming with the goal of keeping these kids at home, in school, and out of the costly juvenile justice system, in our hope, the prison system. On average, the program's working with about 10,000 youth. There is a slide in the PowerPoint that we presented that shows sort of what's happened to the program during the last 8 years. 8 years ago, the funding was at $4.8 million for the biennium. It's currently at three. At that time, there were 67 programs funded, and it's currently at 51. Our goal, if you look at that brochure that I just sent around, and if you look on the very inside where the map is we want every youth that is in need of an early intervention program to have access to these programs. We know it works. We know it saves money, and we need more of it. We've done enough research. We know these communities are just dying for these kind of programs and dying for the funding, and they know that they can also help. It can help leverage their community dollars. So there's also a number of great outcomes, and I'm just going to give you a couple of them that has happened over the life of this program. The recidivism rate for kids that have gone through this program has averaged better than 80%, meaning 80% of those kids that are through this program are not having reoffenses with the juvenile justice system. In that recent survey that the Office of Justice Programs did, it also showed that while the kids were in the program, 90% of those kids were not having reinvolvement in the system. 85% of the youth increased their decision-making skills. 75% of the youth referred for truancy, improved their school attendance and grades. And 86% report that they developed a positive relationship with adults. As Senator Franzen mentioned, we had a ROI done by the University of Minnesota and Wilder Research a few years ago that showed that there's a $4.89 return for every dollar invested in this program. And when you add the 2-to-1 match, that turns into $14.68 a return on investment. So the big issue, of course, is it's currently funded at 3. We're asking at 3 for the biennium. We're asking for 10. We think that will bring in 135 programs, which we think would do a very good job of covering the state. And in closing, I know that money is tight, but what we're asking you to do is consider our request in your omnibus bill. Give this program a shot at growing and reaching these youth, and we will come back in a couple years and show you the outcome results and how many youth were diverted from the juvenile justice system and the money that was saved by keeping them in school, at home, and prepared for a life of being a responsible community member. We have a number of testifiers here today. The first one to my left is the Chief of Police from Cottage Grove, Chief Craig Woolery.
Welcome, Chief.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Committee, for having me here today. I won't echo what Mr. Beatty and Senator Franzen have said. However, I will affirm that it is accurate. I've been with the Department of Cottage Grove for 30 years, and we've had a great relationship locally with a nonprofit called the Youth Service Bureau, and has directly funded through YIPA. So I do see the benefits. It's not that simple a lot of times. I know today, like anybody else, our resources are limited. We can't expect to deal with people over and over again, but over the years I've been with the city, I can't tell you how many countless and hundreds of times we've had examples of poor decisions bad behaviors early on that are corrected by the Youth Service Bureau. A lot of times we find a behavior that's demonstrated on the street. There's issues happening at home. There's issues happening at school. Our local youth intervention has been on top of all that. They're adaptable. They're flexible. They're able to deal with issues that cross all those paths, even though my silo is just law enforcement and criminal justice. I know our Washington County attorney, Pete Orpett, is a wholesale endorser of this diversion program. I can share one quick story with you. A couple of years ago, we had three juveniles, teenagers, who had started a local archery range on fire. A number of shooting bales and stuff, they lit them all up, and it was a big deal. Thousands of dollars of damage. And so the city repaired it, got it fixed, and then they lit it up again. So one afternoon, our fire marshal, who was walking his dog in the park, lives nearby, ends up coming across these kids who are hanging around, talks to them. Well, that night we get a call on our tip line. It turns out the boys he was talking to are the ones, one talked on the other, and finding the three who were involved in setting the fires. Well, one of the three didn't like that much, so he found out where the fire marshal lived and proceeded to break out his windows on his vehicle and spray paint the car. Typically, that would have been a response without a diversion program and petitioning them to court for juvenile adjudication, which could have been months down the road. However, we used a restorative justice process. We had the fire marshal there within a couple weeks. All the juveniles involved, they found out firsthand what the impact had to the area residents who used the archery range and to him for, you know, his vehicle that was damaged. And found out through some feedback through our counselors through the Youth Service Bureau that the parents were desperately waiting for this kind of a wake-up call. They'd been having these behaviors at home. Those same behaviors were being demonstrated at the school. But I can say today, because of what would have simply been of our law enforcement sending them to court, it would have been done with. We had a good intervention. We had some family counseling that followed up with that. They learned how to deal with their impulsiveness and their anger issues. We use youth intervention for every juvenile primary offense, as was stated, from chemical, anger. We've added bullying. We've had fire issues. All those are very important, very important for our community. People come to Cottage Grove to raise kids and raise families, and we've had a great success with that. So with that, I'll end.
Thank you, Chief. Any questions, members, or any questions for Mr. Beattie? All right, Senator Franzen, we have some more testifiers.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have a few more testifiers. I will call Mr. Dan Farr, Executive Director of the Bridge for Youth. At the same time, Paul Ramseur, Executive Director of ELPIS, Inc., and Program Director of Youth Link.
Good afternoon, great. Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
My name is Daniel Farr, and I'm the Executive Director of the Bridge for Youth. I've been doing this in this business of helping youth for 20 years. Youth intervention works. The community match allows programs to get buy-in and control at the local level. Programs are designed to fit the need of the community they are in. The return on investment shows a positive net gain. YIPA, the association, gives both technical assistance and training. It also gives a place for peers and professionals to interact with one another. Let me tell you a little bit about the Bridge. We serve youth in crisis. Most of you think of us as a homeless shelter. We serve kids between the age of 10 and 17. The average age is 14 and a half years old. We serve nearly 1,100 kids a year. Over 42,000 youth served in 42 years. We know a little bit about youth. We train nearly 100 interns from local colleges and universities. Most of our youth come from Hennepin County, but last year, nearly 150 youth came from the 7-county metro area, and nearly 50 youth came from the rural areas. I am sure I could easily find youth and families that have been served from every one of your districts. Something has changed. 10 years ago, less than 10% of our referrals came from juvenile justice. In 2012, 36% of our youth served were either court-involved, dropped off by police, or were juvenile diversion alternative youth. Why has this happened? Well, there's fewer resources than there were 10 years ago in what we call the system. At the Bridge, We've taken some of those hits as well. We're all stretched, doing more with less. That's become the norm. What else has changed? Law enforcement recognizes that alternative placements in community programs are better than traditional juvenile lockup. It works. We take youth who have committed their first offense, often a domestic assault, and instead of placing them in juvenile lockup, they come to the bridge where between the time of their arrest and court, we work with the kids and the families to solve the problem. 507 youth have been brought to the bridge since 2009 under this arrangement. 98% of these kids have returned home or have gone to a safe alternative at the time of court. 98%. I'll figure that out for you. Of 507 youth, only 10 youth did not have a positive outcome. It works. Youth intervention works. It's proven. You've got the data to support this. In this budget, I urge you to make serving youth a priority. Make the investment needed to serve thousands more youth across the state, in their communities, and with adults they trust. Youth intervention works. We need more of it.
Thank you, Mr. Farr. Mr. Ramsour.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Paul Ramsour. I'm currently the president of the Youth Intervention Program Association Board of Directors. I'm also the executive director of ELPIS Enterprises, and I also work for YouthLink. The mission of ELPIS Enterprises is youth development through social enterprise. It's a different kind of intervention program. Youth intervention program for us is offering job training and work experience to disenfranchised youth, ages 16 to 23. The youth in our program have significant barriers to employment, such as education, little or no work experience, housing, or homelessness. Our goal with our youth intervention program is to keep them, is to help them be competitive in the workplace by helping them meet their basic needs. Youth with no employment experience or who are unable to compete in the workplace will sometimes make bad choices to get their needs met. Through the intervention program and advocacy, we have helped youth with mental health issues and homelessness obtain well-paying jobs. Our success story that I'll tell you about today is Jessica, who came to us with mental health conditions and was homeless and living in a shelter. She joined our program, worked in our small businesses, obtained the level of lead, and then obtained the level of coordinator. We helped her get a job with Minneapolis Parks and Rec, where she climbed the ladder there to program coordinator. She recently moved to Colorado to attend school, get to know her family better, and obtained a job as an office manager in a screen printing operation making $30,000 a year. That's what youth intervention can do. We know it works. It saves money, and we need more of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ramsour. Any questions for the witnesses, members? Senator Franz, it looks like you have one more witness.
Mr. Chair, I believe I have two more. Beth Bailey, Executive Director of Community Mediation and Restorative Services, and Tashida Henderson, Youth Intervention Program Participant.
Great. Thank you. Who would like to start?
I'll go ahead. Mr. Chair, thank you, and Senators, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm Beth Bailey, the Executive Director of Community Mediation and Restorative Services. We serve the West Metro area. We're one of nine organizations across the state that provide mediation, community-based mediation services. We seek and achieve wonderful results in holding our youth accountable and standing with them to find success. And we're asking you today to do the same thing with us that we are doing with the youth in our communities. So we hold youth accountable and we stand with them and help them achieve success. We're asking you to hold us accountable and to stand with us and help us achieve success. I'll give you a brief description of what it is that we do. We provide restorative justice services as a diversion service for youth. So, for example, Chief Shellam was here from the city of Robbinsdale, so I thought of a Robbinsdale case. This was a graffiti case, where two youth had spray painted in one of the parks in the city of Robbinsdale. through the referral from the police, or it might have been through juvenile court, we brought them together and sat them down with parents. Actually, it was just one of the youth, with the mother, with a volunteer from the community who worked with the park system, and with neighbors who had sent children and lived around the park. And together they went through this restorative justice process in which everybody got to describe what happened, how they were impacted by it, and then the conversation moved into what can be done to repair the harm. And a plan was developed, and that plan was about writing letters of apology to people in the neighborhood who were impacted. It was about working with the volunteers who adopted that particular park, and it was about working and volunteering some time with the Park and Recreation Department to become connected to the local community. The final step of that process is to have the youth think through, if you're in this situation in the future, how are you going to make a different decision? So it's both reflective, asking the youth to think about what they did, and it wasn't just stuff that was impacted, but to discover it was people that was impacted. And instead of being punitive and simply giving the youth a label, we give them the opportunity to repair the harm, to fix the mistake, to make better decisions in the future, and to be a successful part of the community. We helped over almost 500 youth last year. We received a YIP grant of just under $25,000, and we helped over almost 500 youth last year with this process. We monitor those youth for a six-month period of time, and in order to report them as successful, they have to participate in the process. They have to develop a plan with the victim or the community representatives who stand in place of the victim. They have to complete that plan, and they have to avoid having a second offense in that six-month period in order for us to be able to report them successful. Last year, 96% of our youth, we were able to report successful through this process. Youth intervention works. It saves more money, and we need more of it. Now, the part about holding us accountable, I want you to know what you are doing to hold us accountable through that YIP grant. You heard Mr. Beatty mention that the local nonprofits are required to come up with at least $2 for every dollar that comes through the YIP program. We need to secure private and local support in order to be able to leverage those youth, the YIP dollars. You're holding us accountable in that way to gain and secure local support through that. You're also, we're not asking you to allocate money and then cross your fingers and hope we have good outcomes with the money that you're allocating. You are holding us accountable through a variety of different reporting mechanisms. When we submit our application for a YIP grant, we have to demonstrate how we're using evidence-based practices. We have to provide a report on how we are going to measure outcomes, and we have to indicate how we have the resources to do what we say we're claiming to be able to do. We report quarterly to the Office of Justice Programs. You have access to all kinds of statistics if you really want to know that this is working and that your money is a good investment. Our clients fill out a pre-mediation survey and a post-mediation survey, and the Office of Justice Programs collects that data statewide. YIP agencies are using the same evaluation tools so that you can report and look at the picture of what's happening across the state through those evaluation tools. So we provide youth, we hold our youth accountable, and we stand with them. We're asking you to do the same, to be champions for youth by standing with us through this allocation and by holding us accountable. Allocate the dollars, call us back, and ask us to report to you how those dollars are being used to help youth find their way to success. Youth intervention works. It saves money. We need more of it.
Thank you, Ms. Thank you. Bailey. Questions, members? All right, Ms. Henderson. Welcome.
Good morning. It's not morning. Sleepy. Sorry. I've always been taught that actions speak louder than words. Well, I'm the action. Here I am. I am the oldest of about 12 kids. One mom, no dad, no uncles, no good role models.
So along came the youth intervention programs. I got involved with the community police crew and ended up getting mentored by Officer Tony from the Brooklyn Park Police Department. She helped me get licensed, get involved in college, and staying out of trouble in school. I actually graduated from school on time, and now I work for the city of Brooklyn Park. And I just put in an application for a police cadet. In that program, they help you go get through college, and you got to dedicate 2 years of your life as a police officer in Brooklyn Park. Well, I'm down for anything to help my generation become the next best generation. So with that being said, help us help them stay out of trouble, because I don't see it all. And the last thing I want is one of the 11 brothers or sisters that I have behind bars dead, which I already have one dead, but you live by the streets, you die by the streets. And that's what we're trying to convince, is that the streets is not where it's at. It's education, staying from behind bars, and doing the best you can. You can do whatever you put your mind to. So help us.
All right. Well, congratulations on your success. Thank you for being here, Ms. Henderson. Any questions, members? Senator Champion.
Well, here's my question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I was going to ask you a question, but I know you're nervous right now because I know you're thinking,
no,
oh, my
cold.
God, don't ask me.
This piece of cake, I do this all my life.
Well, I just want to say, you know, thank you for your testimony, and thank you for Senator Friends and the others who are striving every day to make a difference, because I do believe that it is important to make a difference. And so just thank you for your testimony, because I also think it's important to put a face on numbers, because sometimes people hear numbers and they hear things, but it's often really good to hear from someone who says, you know, I've had some challenges, here is the intervention that helped me, and I just want to tell you that that's a wonderful thing, and I think you're being a wonderful role model. So continue to do that.
Thank you.
All right. Excellent. Anything, members? Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File
682?
All right. Anything further, Senator Franz?
Well, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Champion, and yourself, Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, and Senator Senjum for being co-authors of this bill. So it shows a great level of bipartisanship that we agree that this is a good investment for our state. The reason I took this bill up and I met with Mr. Scott Beatty a while back and talked to him, gave him the hard questions about outcomes, accountability, and so forth, and learned that this really is a good bargain for the resources that we're putting into the system. I don't know if a lot of you know, I worked as a law clerk in the public defender's office in Hennepin County, and I did see this firsthand, how young kids, families were in the system, and a lot of times for really bad choices, as children and youth often do. We probably all can think about some bad choices we made when we were younger, but these bad choices have consequences, and a lot of times they have long-term consequences that prevent youth from achieving a job and being a contributor to society as a taxpayer. So I think this is why I believe so strongly in this bill and this funding for this type of program, because it's going upstream and not having our youth being in the cycle of in our criminal justice system and in the cycle of recidivism. It pays off long-term. So I really do encourage you to support this bill. We did have a press conference earlier, and we had great support. I did attend a graduation of one of these programs as well, and it was really amazing to see the energy in that room and the families there and the excitement as they graduate and move forward and doing homework and having all the mentors, as Ms. Henderson mentioned. It does work, and to tag along with the motto here, it works. It saves money, and we need more of it. So thank you.
All right. I think Senator Miller is on your bill, too.
Yes.
And I'll just echo, having been on the board of Youth Link, which used to be known as the Minneapolis Youth Diversion Program, better
name for it now.
Back at home.
And having supervised restorative justice programs myself and having participated in several restorative justice conferences. It is very, very effective and very cost effective. Senator Franzen, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I believe this it would need to go to finance, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Senator Franzen, I think we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Then my motion would be to pass this bill and to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus transportation bill.
Any questions on the motion, members? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you very much. All right. Senator Franzen, Senate File 687. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is Senate File 687, and it is regarding our Safe Routes to Schools program and funding for such a program. Just to give you a little background on this, the Safe Routes to School, I'll call it SRTS for short, is a national and international movement to create safe and convenient and fun opportunities for children to bicycle and walk to and from schools. The program has been designed to reverse the decline in children walking and bicycling to school. Safe Routes to School, SRTS, can also play a critical role in reversing the alarming nationwide trend toward children, childhood obesity, and inactivity. There is a federally funded program that was established in 2005, and several states have established a state-funded SRTS program, including Texas and California. Last year, the House and Senate passed statutory language to establish the Minnesota Safe Routes to School program, but at that time, we were seeking $3 million in bonding dollars to support the new Minnesota program. And I want to thank all the members who were here and supported of that last year. But unfortunately, the funding portion did not make it through, and so therefore we're here today. So why do we need a state program versus a federal program when a federal one already exists? There are several reasons, and I want to point a few of them out. First, the state program allows more flexibility and less red tape. Some of the school districts and communities that have been discouraged from applying for the federal program because of the burdens of administering a federal grant. This state program will make these resources easier to manage and therefore more appealing to smaller districts and communities across the state. Second, under the federal program, high schools aren't eligible for funding, so you leave a lot of chunk of groups left out of this program, and you'll be hearing more about that in a moment from one of the testifiers. Third, the federal funding has not been nearly enough to meet the demand for the resources here in Minnesota. Since the federal SRTS program was created in 2005, MnDOT has received 521 applications for 88 million in SRTS projects and has funded only 148, which is 28% of these applications, totaling only $11.5 million across the state. The last federal funding cycle, MnDOT received 82 applications from local schools requesting $23 million, but only $3.8 million was available and awarded to 16 applicants through the federal program. And finally, the federal funding for SRTS is in jeopardy. In 2012, federal transportation bill cut funding for the federal SRTS program by one-third, further reducing available grants to Minnesota schools. And just to walk you through the bill establishes the SRTS program in Minnesota by appropriating $12.8 million from bond proceeds to fund to the Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Transportation, or MnDOT, for the purposes of capital investments for safe and appealing non-motorized transportation, such as walking and biking, to and from school. The bill also provides for a $3.2 million general fund appropriation to fund some of the non-infrastructure needs to make these programs a success. The goal of the program is to encourage students to walk and bike to school in a safe manner and in a safe environment. There is broad support for this initiative, bipartisan support in both House and Senate, as well as wide range of education, health, local government, and transportation groups. A list of supporters has also been included in your package, so it was about 37, if not more, supporters, so I won't layer the list. The capital investment funds would be used to improve publicly owned transportation infrastructure that provides non-motorized transportations to and from school. I mentioned that some examples of eligible school transportation projects or improvements are creation of sidewalks, improvements of pedestrian and bicycle crossing areas, on-street and off-street bicycle facilities, traffic diversion improvements in the vicinity of schools. The general fund money for non-infrastructure could be used for planning activities, for public awareness, for outreach to press and community leaders, traffic education and enforcement in the vicinity of schools, student sessions on bicycles and bicycle and pedestrian safety, health and environment, and funding for training volunteers and managers of Safe Routes to School programs. There's a lot of benefits for this program, as you've been hearing, and some that my testifiers were going to go to cover some of those. I'm just going to hit high level additional ones. SRTS improves the safety of students who travel to and from schools by walking and biking, increases the likelihood that children will be physically active. We know that the program has shown that this could increase walking and bicycling anywhere from 20 to 200%. It also increased physical activity, increases the likelihood that student academic performance would also improve. So recent studies have found that strong correlation between physical activity and physical education in schools and students' academic performance. And then obesity in young adults, like I mentioned earlier, is a threat to national defense. Mission Readiness, an organization of retired military leaders, has issued a report that says they found that 27% of young people aged 17 to 24 are ineligible for military service due to being overweight or obese. Construction of pedestrian and bicycling infrastructure creates jobs. Each $1 million spent on bicycling or pedestrian infrastructure results in 10 to 11 jobs created compared to 7.8 jobs for road-only construction projects. I do have an amendment as well, if the chair will entertain that now or after
this
the testifiers.
This is the A1 amendment, Senator Franzen?
Yes.
In your packets, members?
It is, and the amendment will provide language for MnDOT to use any general fund appropriations, and the language passed last year only addressing the use of bonding appropriations, so it just clarifies that.
All right. Any questions? This is an author's amendment. All in favor of the A1, say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Carries.
Mr. Chairman, with that, I would like to pass it over to my testifier, starting with Patrick Sullivan, freshman at McAllister, and that has led efforts in Moundsview High School last year to support Safe Routes to School programs.
Welcome, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you very much. My name is Patrick Sullivan. I'm here to talk about why biking to school is important for me and still is. As a student of McAllister College and graduate of Moundsview High School, I'm just here to talk about what biking meant to me in high school and what a lack of a safe route did to my high school. First of all, dependency on licenses to those within a 2 to 4 mile radius of my high school was caused by unsafe bike routes to school. And I'll show you on page 2 of the packet, which you should all have it with. It's labeled Our Ride to Moundsview High School. You can see that on the second page there are two photos of this section of gravel and road before a stoplight. And this is what is preventing many students within the area from biking to school. This certain patch is just within about a 2 mile radius of the school. And fixing this up would definitely allow students within more of a 5 mile radius to safely bike to school. And the problem with this area is there's one unguarded right shoulder where cars coming at around 40 miles an hour have an unguarded right turn that is without a crosswalk. So it is up to the bikers and the pedestrians to care for their own safety. And it's certainly very dangerous for them. On the next page, we have, after you cross the light, there is a guardrail that you have to pick up your bike and bicyclists are forced to put it over the guardrail to continue to school. And this is what personally prevented me from biking to school. I live within a 3.9-mile radius of the school, and it would take about 15 minutes to bike to school if it was a safe alternative. Unfortunately, it wasn't. And I personally do not have my license, my driver's license, and I don't have any regrets about that. Now, as a student of McAllister College, it's lent itself to alternative forms of transportation in the Twin Cities. But I think that students at Mountain View High School should have the means to bike safely to school, especially if they live within such a close radius. And it is important, especially later on, to not build dependency on licenses and to assume that every high schooler has licenses. And I think that, you know, allowing or to build these safe paths to school and not assuming that every high schooler has a license, because I know for a fact that they don't. It would also promote healthy living practices later on, as they realize like maybe they live within a few miles of work, or they move on to college, as more and more students are. They find that their access to cars are often very limited or non-existent. And the next point I wanted to make was that most of these fixes around my high school are very small. It's just a 400 or 500 foot stretch of sidewalk that is preventing students from going to school, and there is one area in particular that students have been hit at, which makes it very unsafe. And the awareness is there at the school as well. If you can please turn to the last page of the packet, there is an article in the Mounds View Viewer, the student-owned publication of our school, and it's labeled "Safer on Two Wheels," and this made the front page of an article at Mounds View High School. So the awareness is there that they know that this is an issue. In fact, the environmental associated club there called Synergy tried to organize a bike to school day recently, and the principal didn't allow them to because even she knew it was unsafe. So again, that gives you an idea of just the lack of safe transportation to the school. And one of the main reasons why I support Safe Routes to School is because it's funding of these high school transportation paths, because I think that high schools are largely ignored, especially when it comes to alternative forms of transportation, because we assume that everyone in high school have licenses. And again, I want to clarify that that is not the point. So just the major points I wanted to get across is that Safe Routes to School is very important because it does promote safe and healthy living practices early on, and it makes pedestrians and bicyclists have safe access to schools, which is a daily commute that would be used regularly, so the funding would not go to waste. And it also creates alternative transportation practices for later on when their access to cars are limited. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Questions, members? All right. Give Ms. Gertken.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jody Gertken. I am a program coordinator for the Blend Coalition, which is Better Living, Exercise, Nutrition Daily. We are based out of the CentraCare Health System in St. Cloud and represent 12 surrounding counties through our region. And as a constituent, I'd like to thank Senator Peterson for his support and co-authoring of this bill, and that would come with those in partnership with Blend and the work that we're doing locally. I'm here today both as a community organizer for physical activity and as a mother of two very active children. I urge you to support Senate File 687 because funding a Minnesota Safe Routes to School program will increase the safety and health of Minnesota children who walk and bike to school. My daughter is 12 and my son is 8 and currently are unable to do so because of some lack of safety or lack of infrastructure. So there are many reasons to support this bill. Briefly, nationally in 2009, more than 23,000 children ages 5 to 15 were injured and 250 killed by cars when they were struck while walking and bicycling. This represents 25% of all children traffic fatalities and 15% of children's traffic injuries. Minnesota, unfortunately, is not immune to this. In 2012, 38 Minnesota pedestrians and 6 bicyclists were killed in crashes with automobiles. Safe Routes to Schools is designed to help prevent those injuries and fatalities, especially when children are walking or bicycling to and from school.
Pediatric physicians, many of whom we work with in our area, have linked the obesity epidemic to unhealthy eating and lack of physical activity. Walking 1 mile to and from school each day equals 2/3 of the recommended physical activity per child per day. When more students walk and bike to school, especially those who live within 1 mile of the school, districts can actually save on busing costs, a substantial budget item for most schools. Traffic around schools often creates enough air pollution to put students, who are among those most at risk from air pollution, in air quality non-attainment zones. Again, safe routes to school helps to reduce the level of automobile traffic around schools. So why are we asking for this today? As you've heard, the existing federal Safe Routes to School program does not adequately fund the safety needs of Minnesota students, as has been earlier referenced. Well, I am pleased to announce that prior to coming here and leaving St. Cloud this afternoon, we were notified that Blend and CentraCare has received a Safe Routes to School non-infrastructure grant application from MnDOT this cycle. We will be working with 5 schools within 3 of our local districts on non-infrastructure activities, including education, enforcement, encouragement, and evaluation. We're happy and very pleased to be doing so, but we also know that other members within our 12-county service area have not risen to the top. And some of those, especially in more rural areas of our counties, do not have the infrastructure and unfortunately, again, have missed out on some of these opportunities because the demand certainly is much greater than the supply in this case. So by funding a Minnesota Safe Routes to School program, the legislature can help keep safe Minnesota students who walk and bike from school and certainly encourage more who currently don't the opportunity to be able to. So with that, I thank you for your support, and I'm free to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Gertkin. Questions, members? All right. And I did notice everyone has a little personalized report about Safe Routes to School activities in their own district, if you haven't taken a look at that. Very useful. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, I think this might be a question for council, but the amendment says the commissioner may not expend an appropriation from the bond proceeds fund or provide financial assistance from such appropriations for the purposes specified in this subdivision. What are those purposes specified in the subdivision that the commissioner can't give money to?
Ms. Berzowski.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, those would be the ones that are listed from 1.11 to 1.16, and that just means that bond proceeds can't be used for those activities, but general fund appropriations can be.
But it says that the commissioner may expend the fund.
May expend.
On B.
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, on 1.5 it says the commissioner may not spend bond proceeds, and then on 1.9 it says the commissioner may expend funds for these purposes that are listed and enumerated below.
So, Senator Tomasoni, there's 2 parts to the bill. There's the bonding, and then there's a general fund appropriation. There's cash, and then there's bonding. And so the bond proceeds can't be used for these activities, 111 through 1.16, because of course bond proceeds are for,
but cash can be used for.
Cash can be. Yeah.
Okay.
Bond
All
proceeds
right.
are for capital infrastructure.
Okay.
All right. Great. Thanks. So, Senator, would anyone else like to testify on this bill? Seeing none. Any other questions, members? Senator Franz, what I think we'll do is we'll lay this bill on the table. We have the bond section, and we're going to be hearing some more bonding bills next week, and then we'll have our list of recommendations to the Capital Investment Committee, and then the general fund portion will lay over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Does that work for you?
That works. Thank you, Mr.
All right.
Chair.
Great. Thank you. With that, that one is concluded, and we have one more bill on the agenda, Senate File 1303, Senator Osmond. Senator Osmick, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 1303 is a very short file or a bill. I'm sort of hoping to have just a shorter presentation to give everybody a few minutes of their time back. This bill funds phase two of the e-workplace telemarketing or telework program. Originally, phase one was implemented with federal funds and state funds, which focused on four different concepts. One was tolls, the other was transit, another was telecommuting, and one was technology. This component would extend into phase two, the telecommuting portion of the bill, and it is designed to continue the telemarketing, which involved previously in phase one, 48 companies of over 4,300 employees. You'll have passed out a packet of information regarding the program, and it provided a 9-to-1 savings for the investment that we made. This was developed through time savings, vehicle savings, and it did not even include environmental or safety concerns in that 9-to-1 return on investment. So with that, I will turn it over to my right, Mr. I'm sorry, I can't even butcher your name. Leo Lari.
Mr. Lari. Welcome, Mr. Lari.
Mr. Chair, a member of the committee, my pleasure to talk about telecommuting. Just want to give you some background. The recognizing that we cannot raise taxes high enough or fast enough or necessarily want to do it to try to build ourselves out of congestion. U.S. DOT in 2007 put over $1 billion on the table and asked applicants to propose use of four T's, tolls, transit, technology, and telecommuting to reduce urban congestion. Minnesota was one of the five successful applicants and received $133.3 million in federal monies, which was combined with local match of $50.2 million to reduce congestion in 35W corridor. Most of these monies were spent to build MinPass lanes, improve transit flow in downtown Minneapolis, build park and ride facilities, buy buses, and accelerate bus rapid transit. Less than 2%, around $3.2 million, was allocated to telecommuting. I had the privilege to work with Minnesota DOT to implement e-workplace initiative and evaluate its results. Goal of the telecommuting initiative was to reduce 500 daily peak period trips through I-35W corridor by encouraging employers to allow employees to telecommute. Considering that not all the employees will use I-35W or Cedar Avenue corridor, we decided on a goal of 2,700 employees. Major effort of the telecommuting initiative was marketing and education, and the initiative was named eWorkplace. I have distributed to you in the report title, Exceeding Expectations. We titled this so because the initiative exceeded the region's contractual commitment and goals. By the end of June 2011, when the project ended, we had officially signed over 48 companies and more than 4,200 telecommuters. Page 4 of the report has a list of the companies. These employers range from small businesses such as Design One with less than 10 employees to Ecolab with over 26,000 employees worldwide. The companies were private, public, and or nonprofit organization. I believe eWorkplace is a win-win-win proposition, is a win for employees, win for employers, and win for the community. Page 6 of the report documents environmental benefit. It is supposed to equal of planting 1,000 acres of forest. Page 7 shows the teleworkers take 93%, so very, very few trips, during peak hours and reduce their daily VMT by 92%. This results e-workplace participants saving 7.5 million vehicles per year. Based on the data collected by eWorkplace, employees' total benefit was about $1,500 annually for vehicle cost and time saving. We heard from employees that it is like getting a pay raise without costing employers any monies. Program benefits surpassed over $6.3 million yearly. Over a 5-year horizon, e-workplace was estimated to yield 9-to-1 return on investment. It is a conservative estimate because this does not include productivity, environmental or quality of life gain, nor include safety benefits. USDOT also hired independent evaluator to evaluate the success of UPA. According to the evaluator, use of telecommuting removed trips and VMT from 35W corridor and enhanced congestion mitigation region-wide, and had secondary benefit of increased employees' productivity. It was found successful. Bill proposed to continue the successful e-workplace initiative, but expand it statewide. Just like original phase, program components will include enhancement of tools and website contents, informational research and development, expansion of employer participation through marketing, education, and recruitment, and providing technical assistance to the employers and employees so they can successfully implement telecommuting at their workplace. It is also proposed that we continue to evaluate the performance of the initiative. I believe telecommuting is the most cost-effective method to reduce congestion by eliminating trips. It is, again, I will say, is a win-win-win proposition. It will also support MnDOT and the Metropolitan Council's transportation demand management strategies described in the statewide transportation policy plan, 2030 Regional Development Framework, and 2030 Transportation Policy Plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lowry. Mr. DeBoer, do you have
Yes. Senator Dibble, members of the committee, I'm Bob DeBoer from the Citizens League, and I'd just like to make a few comments based on our historical work that really supports this telework initiative. In 2005, the Citizens League had a Transportation Finance Study Committee put out a report called Driving Blind. And one of the recommendations in this report was that Minnesota really started to make strategic investments with small amounts of funding to public-private partnerships to be able to invest in pilot projects to test how they worked. And we had a variety of options under there. But most importantly, two things we specifically mentioned were that we needed incentives for telecommuting so that they could be tested on organization-wide levels so that, you know, employers could really start to look at their whole organization and start to think about how much telecommuting could I really use in this organization. And then also just test through the opportunities for communications technology to really start replacing transportation. And this was the impetus for our involvement in the Urban Partnership Agreement, which Mr. Lowry spoke about, and that had a very small portion of funds that went to telecommuting. But we think the results were overwhelmingly positive. When we consider the negative impacts of not only congestion but just road impact, when we have it's not just the congested periods but the crumbling of our roads, and you think about the highest and best way to get to overcome that, it's to eliminate trips. It's not to figure out different ways to build more, to build them stronger. If we can actually eliminate trips, we're able to have a much better impact on congestion, reducing congestion, and on our road use. And telework is really the most efficient way to do that. And the results in the report that you've got show that 78,000 commute trips were removed each day just by the 4,200 employees who were telecommuting. And they also had fewer trips in addition to work trips that they took. So the behavior change was beyond the actual work trips. It actually moved into how many trips and extra trips do I take every day. So that kind of effect, we think, is a real important way to start to look at our transportation system and how we can change our use of it. We think it's a very efficient use of our transportation dollars. It also revealed that a lot more employers are willing to consider this if they have the tools in place to really be able to look. A lot of the difficulty here was in more of the mid-management level line of the employer trying to figure out, well, can we do this? How do we do this? How do we measure things? This program is what helps them do that. So without adding any more than that, I'd just like to say the Citizens League strongly supports phase two of the e-workplace initiative.
Thank you. Questions, members? No. Senator Osmick.
In closing, there's a couple points I'd like to make. I think this bill or this type of direction wouldn't exist 5 years ago or 6 or 7 years ago because employers have moved away from the computer towers as opposed to moving towards iPads for their employee use as well as laptops. And that's what makes this even more applicable to a lot of companies in Minnesota because they're moving in that direction technology-wise. The second component is that I work for a company that very much promotes this type of activity, which is why I'm sitting here today promoting this, in that I have members of my own department that have been telecommuters for, in some cases, up to 5 years. It's not for every job, but there are many applications and many jobs that it does fit to. And certainly myself, I've tried telecommuting, and it doesn't work for me only because I'm too darn distracted when I'm at home with everything that can go around, except in the winter when there's nothing else to do, that it's not necessarily good for me. Or as a project manager, it's not necessarily good for me. However, for certain types of jobs such as computer programmers, database designers, it works exceptionally well because they don't have to commute. And I've had feedback from my employees, some that are currently still telecommuting, that love this option and are actually more productive at home because they could spend more time at home and they don't have to worry about commuting with kids and that kind of thing. So with that, I will close and certainly appreciate your support on this bill.
Thank you, Senator Osmick. Would anyone else like to testify on this bill? All right. And Senator Osmick, I think we will lay this over as well for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Chair.
With that, members, we are concluded. We'll see you on Friday. Thank you very much.